Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I am going to talk mostly about what refinancing will look like after the COVID-19 pandemic and after all of the various interest freezes and payment freezes and when student loans become a thing again. Because let's be real, unless you have a mass forgiveness event, you will have to pay loans again. And because you have Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee and not Bernie Sanders, you are not going to get mass loan forgiveness all at once. So that means some sort of payments will start again at some point. And when they do, what is that going to mean? Certainly, some people will refinance and pay back their debt. Some people will not and go for forgiveness. And the thing is what's happened because of all of this economic turmoil that we've seen in the country, that's going to impact whether or not you should refinance your loans. It's going to probably make our advice more conservative about refinancing than it was before. And our advice was already a lot more conservative than most people's. So let me give you kind of a tale of most people's student loan advice. Pay it off, right? That's what you kind of hear from sort of the anti-debt crusaders out there. Pay off your debt in full, no matter what, right? Even if you're eligible for forgiveness, refinance it and pay it off. That's obviously bad advice, but that's what you hear a lot from folks trying to tell people to just pay off all their debt no matter what. And that's not necessarily the right thing to do. You know that. You know, a lot of people need to go for forgiveness. Historically, what we've told people is if you could benefit from public service loan forgiveness, do not refinance. There's no such thing as hedging your risk with PSLF by refinancing some of your debt. That's a bad decision. That's an awful decision. You know why? At the very best, there's a 50-50 shot that PSLF happens or it doesn't. If you're saying you know more than 50-50 shot, like you're saying 10% chance it happens or whatever, then you know a lot more than I do, right? Because 50-50 just implies that you just don't have any idea what PSLF is going to do. And so if you have a 50% chance that PSLF happens and you have, let's say, $200,000 of debt, and let's say you refinance 50 grand of that debt because you're wanting to, quote unquote, hedge your risk. Well, there's a 50% chance that 50 grand is completely gone, all right, like completely forgiven, like you owe zero tax-free. And then there's a 50% chance that you have to pay that 50 grand back with interest, with maybe, say, instead of 6% interest, maybe you get 4% interest. By delaying that decision to refinance, you're not really costing yourself anything in principle that you wouldn't have already cost yourself. You would pay the principal back either way if PSLF didn't happen, right? So you're not getting any benefit really by refinancing on the principal side of things. All you're getting is you're getting an interest benefit. Well, what's an interest benefit on 50K if you refinance? Well, if there's a 6% rate that you started with and you got 4%, then the difference between those two things is that's a 2% savings. So 2% of 50 grand is $1,000. So by refinancing, you're saving $1,000 plus all the extra years of that interest difference that you would have until the loan's gone. So let's say maximum, you're saving a few $1,000. So would you rather have a 50% shot at 50,000 or a 50% shot at a few $1,000? If you do something called expected value in statistics, you take the probability of one event happening and add it to the probability of the other event happening, you sum the two together and you get the expected value of the bet. So essentially, there's a 50% chance that you get 50,000, which so negative 50,000 plus worst case scenario, let's say $5,000 cost from higher interest payments on that 50 grand because you didn't refinance. So if you add those two together, that is a ginormously favorable bet to take on PSLF. So anybody that, you know, is refinancing part of their loans because they're afraid PSLF's not going to happen, that's really, really bad. That's somebody who is making a very emotion-based bet versus a math-based bet, right? And what do we know about casinos? Casinos love gamblers that gamble based on their emotions. They love that. Why? Because the casinos base everything off the math of probability and make rational, cold, calculated decisions, and that's how they make so much money. So some people will need to go for forgiveness. Some people will need to go for refinancing. Before we get too much more into this, I want to go ahead and actually have some people ask some questions that we have not necessarily gotten to over the past couple episodes. So first, we're going to ask, we're going to have our listeners give us a series of four questions that I'll answer, and then I'm going to come back to discussing refinancing your loans after this pandemic. So let's hear some of those questions from listeners. First, we've got a question from Anonymous on student loans while living abroad.
So the question is, what do you do to pay your student loans when you have to go live abroad? How does it work with the income? And what if you're not going to be working while abroad?
I think that the main thing that you need to think about is if you're going abroad, you're probably going to some foreign school. So some examples of this might be a Caribbean veterinary school, or maybe a Caribbean medical school, or there's also schools in the UK and even Ireland. And I've seen some in Australia. So there are some programs out there that give American students student loans to go to their programs, and then those people will get those degrees, and then they'll come back and practice in the USA, or maybe even meet somebody abroad and stay there. There's a unique rule about the federal student loan system. A lot of these foreign schools, particularly graduate schools, somehow are able to have their students borrow, American students, that is, under the federal direct student loan program. So I've actually seen a lot of people go to like Irish medical schools, get medical degrees, come back and get residencies in the United States, and they actually have federal student loans that are eligible for PSLF. That's kind of a bizarre thing. You know, it's interesting because a lot of times all of these different programs will be a lot more expensive than if you went to a public school. From a federal policy standpoint, it really would make sense to try to force some of the in-state schools to try to expand their offerings. But just know that a lot of times when you go to some of these schools abroad, you're actually able to get federal student loans sometimes and benefit from forgiveness programs. So in general, that's how it works. If you move abroad and you already have student loans, then you can take advantage of something called the foreign earned income exclusion, which gives you a $100,000 basically write-off off of your AGI that you report in the United States earned abroad. So the way this works is if you go to Germany and you earn $80,000, if you have federal student loans, your income in the United States would be zero because it's less than 100. And then that would give you a pay-as-you-earn or revised pay-as-you-earn payment of literally $0 a month. That would allow you to pay absolutely nothing for 20 years and then get forgiveness. So it's a massive loophole. If they ever find out about it, probably they'll try to close it down because it's really almost too good to be true, but it actually does work because we have dozens and dozens of clients around the world utilizing this exact plan for their student loans just because it is legal and it is allowed. So that's in general how to handle student loans while living abroad. We do have a blog post about this. If you go into our Student Loan Planner site, you can type in, you know, how to pay loans when fleeing the country or something like that. And it's got a lot more detailed insights into that. Ryan now has a question about traveling the world without having to worry about your student loan payments.
Hi, Travis. I've got a question about a scenario being on income-driven repayment. What if, for instance, you wanted to take 6 months off to go traveling? Can you do the same situation, whereas if your income had gone to zero, can you certify that your income is zero and not have to make your income-based repayments? Or a situation like if you're a locum physician and you're maybe doing 1 month on, 1 month off, when the month that you're not working, can you say that your income is zero for that month? And then I was wondering what the process is once you do start earning income again, once you're back from your vacation or started working again. How do you kind of certify that you are having income again? And yeah, I wouldn't want to end up in trouble with that process. Thanks, would appreciate your opinion, and thank you for everything that you do.
This is a very personal question for me because I did this when I was 25, and it was one of the best decisions I ever made, traveling around the world, getting to see all the different countries, maybe 40 countries is what I went to, and it would have been a lot harder if I had had to deal with student loan debt along the way because I was trying to live really on the cheap. I was kind of staying in hostels in like Western Ukraine for like $5 a night. But then I was in Sweden and the prices were like $30 for hostels. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, so I totally get the concern about keeping to a budget while you're trying to see the world. And obviously with COVID, who knows when everybody will get to just freely travel again and not have to worry about things anymore. But eventually it's going to happen again. And eventually people, especially people that are relatively low risk of getting this virus, are going to want to travel and are going to want to start seeing things. And especially a lot of people getting laid off. Like when you get laid off, if you have savings, it's kind of like a perfect time in some cases to go travel and do some of these things you've always been wanting to do, but have just never had the opportunity or had the time. So in terms of student loan payments while traveling, what you can do is with most private lenders, you get up to 3 months of forbearance. So you could put your private loans on pause for 3 months. Interest still accrues, but at least you don't have to worry about your payment. For federal student loans, though, remember that you can always get your payment recalculated based on your income. So if you quit your job, the second call can simply be to your loan servicer to tell them, hey, I just lost my job. You don't have to tell them it was voluntary or not. That's not part of the requirement. You can just simply say, hey, I lost my job. I want to recalculate my income-based payments. you can call your servicer. There's actually another way to do this. So if you go to studentaid.gov, what you can do is there's in the menu bar, there's actually a thing that says manage loans. And if you hover over that, there's something that says apply for an income driven repayment plan. It's basically this thing that's called lower my payments. Now, if you scroll down, you'll see four different buttons. One of them will say recalculate my payment. So it says if your income or family size has changed, you can request that your IDR payment be recalculated to reduce your current monthly payment. So that's precisely how you would do it. You could either call if you want the easy option, or you could go onto the website and go click on the recalculate my payment option. Either way, you should be able to recalculate your payment to $0 a month. And especially if you have a balance that is going to be going for forgiveness, basically, that's your plan. Keep in mind that payments made at zero a month while unemployed actually still count towards 20 or 25 year income-driven forgiveness. They don't count for PSLF because you're not employed full-time by a not-for-profit employer during the time you're traveling the world. But they do qualify for the 20 or 25 year forgiveness version. So if you are going for that version, the only thing you're falling behind on is the tax bomb. But you know, you can also prepay the tax bomb savings. So like, let's say you have to put away $500 a month for your tax bomb, and that's $6,000 a year. Well, if you drop in your $20,000 bonus into your brokerage account, you kind of prepaid your tax bomb for 3 years, and you can kind of not worry about it for a while. So there really is a way to travel the world with a massive, massive student loan burden and do it in a really responsible way. And you know, I would really, again, very much encourage anybody who's, you know, not in a serious relationship, doesn't have kids, go do that, because what'll happen is eventually you will meet somebody, more than likely than not. Eventually, there's a more likely than not chance that you might have kids. And when that happens, it's unexpected, it's not predictable. And when it happens, suddenly you're not able to take advantage of some of the crazier things that you would do as a single person that you would never dream of doing as somebody that's older. For example, I took a random bus in kind of the middle of nowhere Poland to the middle of nowhere Ukraine. And it was a really kind of crazy bus ride. You know, basically like these semis were coming, they'll pass other cars into your lane when I was there. And the rule is you're supposed to pull off alongside the road and let them go by. You're not supposed to kind of expect that they're going to stop. So that was pretty shocking. I mean, certainly kind of crazier things I probably would never want to do with a family. I got to experience as a younger man, and I'm really glad that I did. So really encourage this listener, Ryan, to get out and explore the world when it's safe and ethical and everything to do so. And don't worry about your student loan payments while you're doing it. Now we have a comment by Erica.
Hi, Travis. I just wanted to send you guys some positive feedback. I just finished listening to the mental health podcast that was just uploaded on YouTube. And I thought it was a great podcast. I thought it talked about very touchy subjects and very real subjects about student loans. It was really cool to hear you express your view about schools, because I've never really heard anyone say that. Schools wouldn't say that on their own, that they think they're charging too much or like not thinking about their students because of all the student loan that they have to take out. So I thought it was really nice to hear that from you. And I appreciate you so much more for being honest and being like a human being that actually cares about students with student loan debt. So I just wanted to send some positive feedback, because I think you're really making an impact, and I want you to keep making podcasts and putting information out there. I also have a YouTube channel and have mentioned Student Loan Planner on there, and I'm going to keep doing that because I think Student Loan Planner is the best resource out there. I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you very much.
Wow. I got to admit, I'm a little emotional hearing that. I really appreciate that, Erica. It's been really hard. I mean, I'm just going to be real honest, y'all. It's been really hard sometimes just trying to keep everything together during this time. I mean, there's just been a lot of challenges in general with like trying to keep everybody employed, as many people as I can employed as possible. I mean, imagine if you were in a mortgage business, you know, refinancing people's mortgages, if that was a big part of your business, and suddenly the interest rate went to zero. It's pretty hard to compete against. It's pretty hard to have revenue in that environment. And that revenue that we get from doing things like student loan consults, refinancings, advertisings for different things we do, that pays for all the free content that we do, and it helps support the mission and does all that and allows us to give away scholarships and things like that. And when a lot of that stops, I mean, I've sort of been taking a lot of personal risk trying to make sure that everything sticks around so that when the people need help with their student loans again, even more than they do now, we'll be there. I really appreciate that, Erica. I mean, you know, the main thing is I want to do this as long as we can help people and as long as we're making a difference. That's ultimately the goal. It's not to sell Student Loan Planner for millions of dollars. It's not to get famous or something. It's just, I don't know. I really appreciate that. It's like, also, I don't want to get into it too much because, you know, but like family job stuff has been very challenging with the economy and everything. Not me personally, but family in general, extended family, people have lost their jobs. So it's been hard all around. So it means a lot that you shared those words, just, you know, dealing with the pandemic and the economic fallout. And, you know, as a kind of a white male, I don't have to deal with the systemic racism that African-American brothers and sisters do, but getting reminded that we live in such an imperfect country. I don't know. There's just been a lot going on, right? There's just been a lot going on. And I really appreciate it. I mean, at the end of the day, the listener, you are important. You are very important. You are not your debt. Your debt is not a debt sentence or a death sentence, right? This is a problem that can be fixed. It's a, unlike some sort of medical condition that might not have a 100% cure rate, student loans are virtually 100% cure rate. If you get a plan, if you really kind of realize what it is and what it isn't, if you know all the rules, you know all the hacks, you know how to handle your finances, literally student loans are just a problem that has a cure. And so I really appreciate that. I hope we can put out more content like that. And I hope that schools, I hope that some school administrators will hear some of the stuff we say in the podcast and they'll take that as a challenge. At the end of the day, do you want your career to be defined as higher enrollment numbers, higher revenue for the school, higher student retention, and more profitability for your institution? Or do you want people to remember you as a positive force for change, as somebody who stood up to their employer and said, hey, we shouldn't be charging students this much. Hey, maybe we should try to come up with ways to make this more affordable for students. Hey, maybe we shouldn't force students to buy the $10,000 set of dental equipment when we could probably allow them to buy some of their own equipment and save a lot of money on that. I mean, there's got to be people, good people at the schools that are going to stand up and help fight for mental health for students. And I just hope those people stand up too. And I know they're out there. So thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate it. Now we have a question from Chris about long-term disability and how that affects your IDR payments.
Hi, Travis. My wife and I are wondering, if she goes on long-term disability, how does that affect her student loans from the federal government? I know income from policies are tax-free. How does that affect her student loan payments?
So that's a great question. I'm really glad that you asked that because it forced me to go back to the data and actually read the rules again, which is always a fun thing to do. So it says specifically, if you're not going to use your tax returns to certify your income, then you have to provide alternative documentation of income for all taxable income that you receive. So taxable income includes employment, unemployment income, dividend income, interest, tips, and alimony as an example. But it specifically says you should not include documentation of untaxed income. So untaxed income is some of the examples they use: supplemental social security income, child support, or federal state public assistance. So what that's telling you is tax-free disability payments would be untaxed income, and that would not need to be counted in your determination of what your IDR payment should be. So you can leave that disability payment out of IDR recertification. You just need to make sure you use alternative documentation of income to do that if you're recertifying with obviously an income that's lower than what you probably earned before claiming that long-term disability. All right, thank you for listening to those. Now, to get back to the original theme of today's episode of refinancing after a pandemic and paying your loans back after a pandemic. So eventually COVID-19 and the economic consequences of it will end. Eventually, we know that 100%. And the reason is eventually people decide, no matter how bad an event is, be it World War II or World War I or the Vietnam War, or the Great Depression, or all kinds of horrible things that have happened in our country's history, people decide that they're ready to buy houses again and buy cars and go start businesses and live lives, right? So eventually that's going to happen. We just don't know how long and how deep that negative economic impact will be. And when you do have to start making payments again, be it on October 30th, when a lot of people's payments are due right now with their NSLDS files, or later than that, if they extend the CARES Act, which they probably, I think, might. So eventually those payments start again. Now, here is the big thing that you need to know. Vice President Biden has proposed changing student loan income-based repayments. He's proposed changing it from 10% of your income for 20 years to 5% of your income with no tax bomb if you're doing loan forgiveness in the private sector. So if you think about that, that is an extraordinarily generous change if he were to pass that. President Trump wants to change things from 10% of your income for 20 years to 12.5% for 30 years for graduate students. So that would be obviously much worse and would cause more people to refinance than are currently doing. Now, again, all the Republican proposals have always talked about grandfathering. They grandfather people in based off of the current rules that exist today. So I've never seen a proposal from a Republican yet on student loans that eliminates everybody's ability to use the current repayment plan that they're already on. That said, if we think about the Biden plan, so here's kind of some real back of the napkin math. So we've prepared a couple blog posts to look at the cost of various loan forgiveness programs with the different presidential candidates, and we found some stunning stuff. The Biden plan, we project, would cost over 10 years about $2.9 trillion. And the Trump plan, we project, would cost borrowers about $250 billion at least. So the $2.9 trillion would be a higher cost to the federal government. The $250 billion cost for the Trump plan would actually fall on borrowers in the form of worse repayment options. So with Biden's plan of allowing you to pay 5% of your income, the reason I don't think that's going to pass because of how extraordinarily expensive that change would really be. It would be enormously more expensive. And so because of how expensive it is, I don't know if it would happen quite like that. I think you could see him maybe do that for undergraduates only, perhaps, and leaving grad students out of that. But let's say that that happened. Let's say that it did happen. If you did have 5% of your income as a payment option and no tax bomb, then that would change the math drastically on refinancing. So just to tell you what that would do, so right now we tell people that if you owe less than 1.5 times your income and you work in the private sector and you have an emergency fund that you've savings that you've put away, if you have all of those things, then you can refinance. If you don't have an emergency fund, if you don't work in the private sector, if you don't have a debt to income ratio less than 1.5, then you should wait to refinance. Even if eventually you should be refinancing, and I'm talking specifically about federal loans, by the way. Private loans, you should always refinance if you can find a better interest rate. But for federal loans, you should not refinance them unless those three things are true. Again, private sector, emergency savings, and having a debt to income ratio less than 1.5. What that last one means is if you have $100,000 of income and you owe less than $150,000 of student loan debt, then you should refinance if the other two things were true. There's a couple exceptions, but they're kind of very nuanced ones. So what would happen if you were able to pay 5% of your income with no tax bomb instead of 10% with the tax bomb? So if you made that change, the math works out like this. To justify refinancing and paying back your student loan debt, you would need to have a debt to income ratio of lower than 0.6, which is absolutely stunning. So for example, if you had $100,000 of income, you would need to owe less than $60,000 to justify refinancing and paying back your debt. That's really, really low. That would take a lot of the people who are refinancing today and turn them into people that should not be refinancing if that Biden plan were to pass. There is a possibility that something like that could get passed via an executive order. That's how the repay and the pay-as-you-earn plans came into being, is because of executive orders under the Obama administration, which obviously, you know, Vice President Biden was a part of. So you could potentially see some action on executive orders around that. I don't think that you would, because I think Congress might push back, and Congress certainly can push back on an executive order and change the rules if they think something isn't necessarily the right policy. So it's kind of up in the air. And so it's probably not going to be like 5% of your income. It's probably not going to get that low. What I think is it's a negotiating position. You know, Trump is saying we want to have higher IDR payments. Biden, rather than just saying, I like the way things are, he's running for election, right? He has to have a plan. So he says, I want people to pay less than what they're paying now. And then maybe that middle ground, that negotiated position with the Senate Republicans, which even if the Democrats take the Senate in the fall, you're still probably not going to have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate with the Democrats. It probably won't happen, which means that you'll have to compromise with whatever Republican faction is there, which would likely be more conservative if you lose some of those moderate members. So anyhow, you know, I think that what would happen is that IDR payment will probably stay at 10% for graduate students. That's kind of what I'm betting. If I'm a betting man, that's what I would bet. is that your pay-as-you-earn payments, whatever that repay payment is, that'll stay about probably unchanged. The thing that probably will change in a Biden administration is no more tax bomb. I think that'll get passed at some point during his administration, particularly because the CBO is not really even monitoring the cost of it until around 2031. So that's when the first tax bomb is supposed to hit. So technically, the CBO would start monitoring it in 2021, and they wouldn't really seriously start monitoring it until you started seeing like waves of tax bombs expected to happen, which would be in the mid-2030s, which that would start showing up in 10-year budget forecasts in the mid-2020s, which would presumably be around the time when Biden would no longer be in office if he says he's going to be a one-term president, which he's stated. So I really could see that proposal pass. The reason why I think that is if you look at Minnesota, there was a state Republican legislator who pushed the idea of eliminating taxes, state income taxes on student loan forgiveness for Minnesota residents. And he passed that successfully. And part of the reason he passed that was because the state budget office did an estimation of what the cost would be by foregoing that revenue. And they didn't really have a good answer. They didn't really have a good estimate, and they had no idea how to model it. And so they said, basically, since this revenue source is way off into the future and we don't know how to model it, we'll assume that the impact will be negligible. And if you look at the CBO report that they recently did on the cost of income-driven payments in February, the CBO basically said, well, we're just not going to model this because we don't really know how to model it. So that's really kind of a little disconcerting because they don't even know what the cost is. So based off of that, that's why I think that you might see some sort of congressional action that's fairly nonpartisan, fairly kind of bipartisan action taken that just says, well, since we don't really know how to model it, we might just eliminate this tax bomb. So what that means is essentially this. Probably having a debt-to-income ratio lower than 0.6 to refinance is too conservative because probably the full Biden plan will not pass. And certainly there's been plans in the past like Senator Elizabeth Warren's plan that have talked about eliminating deductions for higher income earners on their pay-as-you-earn or income-based payments. So that would actually make you more likely to refinance if the terms of forgiveness for the government plans were less. So what we think now is that instead of a 1.5 debt-to-income ratio, you should probably have lower than a 1-to-1 debt-to-income ratio to justify refinancing. So in other words, if you owe less than what you earn, then you also need to have an emergency fund and also work in the private sector. And if you have all of those things combined, then you could justify refinancing. So if you could justify refinancing, that's when you would do it, is if you had a debt-to-income ratio below 1-to-1. Which is really a lot more aggressive, you know, of a debt-to-income ratio, or a lot more, I guess you could say, a lot lower debt-to-income ratio than 1.5-to-1. So in other words, a lot of the dentists out there that have $250,000 of income and maybe $350,000 of debt, a lot of those people have been thinking about refinancing and do tend to refinance. What I'm saying is that kind of a dentist might actually, in this new regime of more generous student loan rules, that dentist might want to avoid refinancing because of just all of the action we're seeing on the student loan front and all the policy ideas we're seeing on student loans. You know, Senate Republicans wanted to allow people to pay as a percentage of their paycheck. If you allowed that, then a bunch of people could set up S corporations like healthcare professionals, pay themselves an artificial $120,000 wage, which is what a lot of people do as is to avoid Social Security and Medicare taxes. And then you could just pay 10% on 120 grand, even if you're making $300,000-$400,000 a year. I mean, those are the kind of things that I think you would see if you saw some of the plans out there actually become law. I've not seen too much talk about making student loan IDR payments less generous since the PROSPER Act was proposed by House Republicans back in 2017. So, you know, House Republicans were the sort of the conservative faction pushing that really hard. Senate Republicans, more moderate, they pushed back and said, hey, we don't really particularly support this as much. That's really why you didn't see the PROSPER Act get passed, because you'll recall in 2017, that was unified Republican control, you know, White House, Senate, Congress, everything. Why didn't the PROSPER Act pass? Why are you now not paying 15% of your income instead of what you're paying, which is 10? The reason, I think, is because you, one, need a filibuster-proof majority to get something done quickly in the Senate. And when you try to shortcut that, that costs you a lot of political capital, and you can only get so much of that done. So Republicans in the Senate, they proposed this PROSPER Act, and you know it never really got out of the House to the Senate to be in front of the president to sign. It just never went anywhere. And why is that? It's because the ACA repeal was a bigger priority, which failed. And then all of the political capital got pushed towards the tax reform bill, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And that finally got passed, but that was where they spent all their political capital from the election. So I think that you could potentially see something like that. Certainly Biden has made student loans a lot more of a centerpiece of his campaign than President Trump did, for sure. But Biden has several different things on his agenda. First and foremost will be getting us out of the pandemic if he were to win an election. The pandemic economic consequences, that is, I guess, as well as the public health consequences. And so I think student loans will be a thing, but I think that they're not going to necessarily be the focus of his administration, which means that you could see a status quo situation with some sort of tweaking around the edges, which might be no tax bomb, might be slightly more generous terms. But, you know, I mean, Biden's student loan plan, it is very, very, very complicated. We did a really detailed analysis on this on the blog. If you want to check that out, just go to studentloanplanner.com/blog and you'll see that post. But it is so comp. There's so many different components of it. And there's so many ways that you could save money with federal loans, honestly. If you have private loans, maybe not so much. So, I mean, for people that are clear-cut refinancing cases, for federal loan borrowers right now, what I'm telling them is just wait until after September 30th to refinance. You can apply and you have your offer sitting in front of you basically for 30 days before it expires in most cases. So you could really apply, you know, as soon as like the first week of September if we don't get a stimulus act that extends student loan forbearance. So here's kind of also what I think is going to happen with student loan, the CARES Act extension. So I think that you're going to start seeing in mid to late July, they're going to start negotiating the last stimulus that's going to happen before the election, because they're just not going to want to do anything really close to the election. I think that they're going to want that stimulus bill to last up until the election and slightly after that, so that if Republicans do lose, that they'll be able to slam on the brakes a little bit, maybe try to eliminate some of these stimulus things to make it not kind of status quo that there's a bunch of stimulus. So kind of my thought process might be that you'll see some sort of extension, you know, maybe till the end of the year or something before the new Congress is sworn in. I don't really know exactly what it'll look like. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball. But if we have a extension of the student loan interest freeze, I think we'll see it in mid to late July, and it'll be announced around like maybe late July, early August, because the servicers are required to send out notices of payments to be made as of August. They're supposed to send in 6 notifications, payment notifications to borrowers from different sources, mail, email, everything, that their payments are going to start again. And that has to start in August, according to the CARES Act legislation. So that means that they have to do something in late July if they're going to do something. If you don't see anything happen with that, then in September, that's when I would, if as a federal loan borrower that needs to refinance, that's when I would start refinancing. So the people that I would suggest refinancing would be only people that have that debt-to-income ratio below 1:1, just because of how uncertain things are right now. And if you are a marginal case, which is people in that debt-to-income ratio of 1 to 1.5, some people like to refinance anyway with debt-to-income ratios as high as 2, even though we tell them not to. They realize that their savings rate is the most important thing, and they don't like the idea of being in debt for 20 years, and they live on rice and beans, and they pay it all off, and that's great too. Some people like to take an approach that's psychologically the most pleasing, if not the mathematically the most pleasing. So we get that. But if you are a marginal refinancing case where you think you maybe should, maybe you shouldn't, you probably should wait until after the November election. Because if you have a Biden presidency, you're going to see a lot more generosity towards federal loan borrowers, would be my prediction. And if you have a Trump presidency, I think you will see mostly status quo for current borrowers. For future borrowers, I think you'll start to see some of these programs get peeled back a little bit for people who are not already enrolled in a program. But I would hate to see somebody refinance their loans and then there's an extra CARES Act extension for 6 more months that we weren't planning on. Or Democrats win election and they make people pay 5% of their income instead of 10%. And now you shouldn't have refinanced unless you had that 0.6 or less debt to income ratio. You know, I mean, I certainly feel bad for not being able to anticipate that they were going to do the CARES Act. I mean, I don't know how anybody probably could expect me to know that, because that was unprecedented, absolutely unprecedented. We're even seeing all kinds of issues with like the banks. Like for mortgages, for example, they look at your required IDR payment to calculate what you're eligible for a mortgage. But because the nation is in a forbearance, it's mandated basically by Congress, but they don't have that in their system of things that could happen. They actually are defaulting to their usual system for forbearances, which is we're just going to take 1% of the principal balance and say that's your required payment. And so a lot of people are not qualifying for mortgages based off of these rules, which just never anticipated something like the CARES Act ever. I mean, just the idea that you were just going to suspend all student loan interest, all payments, and count it for forgiveness, that's just unheard of. It's never been thought of before it actually happened. And that's kind of showing you what the real risk of refinancing is, which is that there's, to quote Donald Rumsfeld, right? There's the known knowns, there's the known unknowns, and there's the unknown unknowns. I saw that quote the other day, and I thought that was kind of an interesting quote. So the unknown unknowns for student loans, what are those? Certainly for somebody that doesn't know all the rules behind student loans, there's a lot of unknown unknowns that you don't know. That's why people hire us for student loan plans a lot of times, is to make sure they're not missing anything, because most people do miss something, be it the double debt loophole, the breadwinner loophole, the double consolidation loophole, the married filing separate loophole, interest subsidies, payment caps, dealing with servicers. I could go on and on with things people miss. But then there's also unknown unknowns for me. There are things that I don't know because I can't predict what Congress is going to do given a specific crisis that nobody anticipated. And they decided, we're just going to say, screw it. We're going to spend trillions of dollars and we're going to take care of all of our people. And that was a bipartisan thing that happened in a big hurry. I mean, that bill kind of came out of nowhere and got passed very, very rapidly with a very large bipartisan consensus because there was a crisis. That's kind of seemingly the only time Congress will get anything done very quickly is in the middle of a crisis. So what future things could happen to make student loans not as big of a deal if they're federal? I don't know. But I will say this, probably almost surely, if you have less debt than what you earn and you're in the private sector, you should pay it back. You're probably not going to get a big benefit. You probably should get rid of your debt. There's no positive reason to keep the debt around just to keep it around, charging you interest. Listen, we should have gone for public service loan forgiveness, my wife and I, but the problem is, she had a lot of bad advice given to her, didn't consolidate, then consolidated the wrong way. Fed loan lost a bunch of credit. Our payments would have been too high relative to income to really have much left to forgive. And so it was kind of a wash whether we should go and try to get 20, 30,000 of forgiveness out of her six-figure amount after 10 years of qualifying credit, or if we should just pay it off. And we paid it off. And guess what? I don't feel bad about it at all. I'm really glad that we're debt-free. I wish that we had gotten PSLF because she makes a lot less money as an academic physician compared to a private practice physician. And that's supposed to be kind of one of the added benefits of being in academia, trying to help, you know, a lot more patients of modest means than being in private practice, making a higher income. But we didn't get that benefit. And at the end of the day, it's okay. We don't have debt. We don't have to worry about that. And I want to support anybody who wants that path for themselves. I understand that's a really, really wonderful path to take. But don't get so in love with the idea of having no debt that you take on a giant burden that you're not really ready for and willing to accept. A lot of times when people do get mad at us, sometimes they're like, we tell them they need to go for a forgiveness plan. They're like, no, I want to pay my debt off. And then we're like, okay, this is what that would look like. You have to pay $2,000 a month for 5 years. And then we'll get another response that's like, well, I'm upset about that. And it's like, well, you said you wanted to pay the debt off and you also can't afford the payment. So you can't have it both ways. You can't simultaneously have the debt be paid off and have a really low payment. It just is not possible unless you're going to go for like PSLF loan forgiveness that discharges the debt. So you can't wave a magic wand. And so you have to either be willing to pay a ton of money towards your debt, or you have to be willing to take a chance on loan forgiveness. And if you take a chance on loan forgiveness, if you don't have an adequate amount of savings going away, if you don't have a lot of money going away into retirement accounts and brokerage accounts, then you're not going to have a really good financial future anyway. But that's not because of your student debt. That's because your savings rate sucked. So that's kind of the reality, is if you go for forgiveness, you need to make sure all that money that would have gone into loans goes into your assets. And if you're going to pay your debt back, certainly don't neglect saving for retirement and having something going into a brokerage account while you're paying that debt off. But realize that because of the political tea leaves around student loans, there is a movement to make paying student loans less and less expensive. And there has been even less effort to try to contain costs for higher education. It's very unfortunate that it's not helping anybody, regardless of what your political views are. The high cost of education is kind of ridiculous. And there's a lot of ways you could deal with that, but they're just not being dealt with. And so the solution to the student loan crisis, rather than doing the really hard thing of regulating the schools, who have amazing lobbyists to prevent regulation, I think, rather than regulate the schools, we're basically saying, well, why don't we just let consumers pay almost nothing on their student loans? Which I have to say, like when I looked at the Biden plan and I analyzed it, I actually think that Bernie Sanders' plan might actually be cheaper. It might actually literally be cheaper just to forgive everything and hopefully regulate the schools and what they can charge. That'd be the sixth part two of that versus Vice President Biden's plan, which is, you know, when you're paying 5% of your income with no tax bump, I mean, that's virtually like paying nothing. I mean, you're paying almost nothing on your student loans. I mean, you're basically paying a state income tax with a relatively low state income tax rate for your student loans for, you know, basically an unlimited amount of debt. And you're only paying it for 20 years. So, I mean, really, that would be quite stunning if they did that. I think that eventually we're going to realize that the full-on free education period or the full-on private loans only kind of system. I mean, I think one of those systems, I don't know which one, but one of those systems makes more sense than the mess we have currently and the mess we'll probably have after the November election, given that you don't have a lot of stomach for strong action either way. So we'll see what happens. But for those considering refinancing, you know, certainly refinance your private loans right now. Rates have really fallen. They're like 3.2% fixed for 5 years, 4% for 10 years, 4.8 for 20 years for some of the best rates out there. Studentloanplanner.com/refi, R-E-F-I. That's for private loans. There's also some variable rates out there that are like 1.9-ish for 5 years is the lowest. So certainly you could get some low rates if you missed out on some of the refinancing wave that happened in early March when rates were super low and the companies hadn't pulled out of the market yet. You're seeing a lot of these companies come back into the market in a big way and have demand again to help people refinance. It's not the ultra, ultra low rates that we've seen in the past, but it's only maybe about 0.25% higher than the lowest rates ever, probably on average. So that's good news. So if you have private loans, definitely refinance. If you have federal loans, you know, again, probably be careful, be cautious. If you're one of these people that is a marginal case and you're not sure if you should be refinancing or not, we would love to help you with that. To make sure that you do not miss out on any of the unknown unknowns about your student loans. Again, payments are going to start again, and the rules are not going to change massively, most likely. And so we would love to get a plan for you. That's studentloanplanner.com/help. Finally, if you're just a listener that wants to ask a question for free, we would love to get that question or comment as well. So just go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. You can type that into your browser, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Just press a quick record, leave a 30-second question or a comment. I love getting those. It definitely encourages me. I love answering those questions in our show. So we'll get to that in a future show. We'll answer your question. Thank you, everyone. I hope you have a great week and stay healthy and don't make any rash financial decisions and don't let that stuff stress you. Things are going to be fine. You just got to stay calm, stay the course, stick to your plan. It's all going to be okay.